Tonight we've got lecture three. Let's take a look tonight at the, we're going through the existence, the arguments of the existence of God. And before we open the prayer, let me just remind you what we're doing here. We are not in any way, at least my intention, is not to teach you and tell your kids that this is what they're going to learn. They're going to have these slides and they're going to have a good book and they're going to go to college and give this to their atheist professors. That's not going to work. That's not the point. The purpose of this class is to equip, well, anyone who comes, but specifically these kids going off to colleges, to the colleges, into the universities, to know that what they believe is true, that there is a solid, unbelievably solid argument and foundation for what they believe. I think a lot of parents, because they know, don't know much more than to tell their kids, you need to believe this because it just is true. You just need to believe it. That's the way I was taught. It's not a bad thing, but there is a foundation for what we believe, and a good argument can be made. And I'm hoping to be able to equip you, at least show you an intro class that there is something to say for those who would tell you what you believe is ridiculous. All right, with that said, let's open the word of prayer. Pray with me. Lord, I want to thank you again for our time. Thank you for those gathered. Thank you for our Lord Jesus Christ. Lord, we gather in his name. We come to worship you tonight in knowledge, asking you to fill our minds and our hearts with all the truth that we can handle. Lord, I pray that we would be considered by you to be responsible enough to be given the knowledge that you so lovingly give to us, that we could retain it, that we could go out in our evangelism and give people a hope for what the reason for the hope that is in us. And Lord, as always, I pray that we would defend the faith whenever we are asked about it with love and with the intent of bringing someone else to Christ. They may be angry at us and they may hate us. I pray, Lord, that we would show them the love of Christ in the midst of our presentation. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, we have looked at a couple of arguments for the existence of God. Number one, what was number one? You remember the word? Okay, truth. We're looking for truth, but this real like fancy apologetics word, the ontological argument for the existence of God. The ontological argument for the existence of God is this. I'm here, I'm thinking, I'm doubting, which means that I'm thinking, which means seemingly that I exist. If I exist, then something eternal has to exist. Because I and you are finite beings. We die, we come on the scene, and we're gone. And it happens over and over and over. And everything that we see, the universe, us, everything in this universe, in this closed system universe, is moving toward a state of non-being. It's called the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy. Well, if everything is moving towards a state of decay, then something must be eternal. So if I exist, something eternal has to exist to have created all that exists. The second argument we looked at was the cosmological argument for the existence of God, and it's based on basic laws that we know to be true, the law of cause and effect. You and I are an effect. Something caused us, our mom and dad. They caused us. Or we could keep going back in time all the way to the beginning and say, all right, we were caused, if we believe the Bible, by Adam and Eve. All right, well, who caused them? Or better yet, what caused them? Some would say, better yet, what caused them, not who. But you can keep going back. Something caused it. What caused everything that is here? So the ontological argument and the cosmological argument are very similar. They borrow from each other. There had to be a first cause. Hence, cosmological argument for the existence of the world. That's what cosmos is. Change it to cosmological argument. What was the cause of all things? Was it chance, evolution, nothing exploding into everything, which is absolutely absurd? Or an eternal being that created everything out of nothing. It's perfectly logical for that to happen. So the ontological and the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Today, we're going to look at what's called the teleological argument, or better yet, the divine design argument. Why is there design in the universe? Or is there design? Here's the way the logic rolls off. Number one, every design had a designer. No matter what that design is, it had a designer. If we painted a picture on the wall, the picture, you would know someone painted the picture. Every design has a designer. The universe has highly complex design. When we look at it, you can look at anything. You can take anything within the universe and see complex design. That's true. Therefore, the universe had a designer. So if all things that are designed have a designer and the universe has a great intricate design in it, then it must have a designer itself. That's the logic. What did the ancient philosophers say? Well, Plato believed in a, quote-unquote, best soul who is the maker and father of all, the king, quote, who ordered the primordial chaos into the rational cosmos we observe today. He wrote this in his writings called Laws. Aristotle, his student, believed that there must be a first unmoved mover, which is God, in his writings, Metaphysics. So even the ancient philosophers are looking out, and they were astounded with what they saw in the stars, just by looking at the stars. Something created it. Now, they weren't into the Jewish God. They were, you know, Plato and Aristotle are in the 5th and 4th century B.C., and they would have existed alongside, maybe, possibly, bordering on Nehemiah or Malachi, but they were not in Israel, and they were not most likely not reading the writings of Moses. But God existed. There was much going on in Israel in those days. These guys are looking up the stars and saying, yeah, there's got to be something that created it. Thomas Aquinas, we looked at him last week. The Middle Ages philosopher, Roman Catholic, believed in an unmoved mover. We looked at that last week. And he said that everything that we see out there today is in motion. Something, logically, had to set it in motion. He also believed in a first cause. Again, back to the cosmological argument. For everything that exists, something had to eternally exist to make everything that exists exist. He also believed in the existence of contingent beings. You and I, we come on the scene and we die. That means that we are contingent. We are unnecessary. If we were necessary, we would always be. But he said, there's no way everything has to be contingent. There must be a non-contingent being. Teleologically, and by the way, this comes from a Greek word called, which means the end or finish, telos. Hence the end, what we see as an end product, the logical argument is something created it. He says this, teleologically, we observe in nature that all things move toward an end, even when they lack consciousness. Apple seeds into apple trees, acorns into oak trees, arrows go into their intended target, thus all things to their telos or their end. Everything is moving toward an end. A tree grows up, a little kitten is born, they grow into a cat. Everything that we see is growing towards an end, a logical end. William Paley, ever hear of this guy? He's basically the creator. He's not the creator of this argument, but he set it in motion with the parable of the watch. He says, if I stumble upon a rock and I kick my stubs his toe on it, he can look down, he can look down and he can say that rock has probably been there for eternity. But he said, I know if I stumble upon a watch, however, I can't say that that watch has been there for eternity. He looked at the human body, he saw a watch, and he pointed to a maker. It's one thing to see a watch or a rock on the ground. It's another thing to see an intricately designed watch. You ever open a watch? Now I recognize, I have a tick-tick watch, and watches are digital today, a little bit different, but even if you open up a digital one, if I were to open up this watch here, there's an intricate design of gears and springs, and what covers it is this plastic see-through cover that protects it. And the back of it, if I open it up, has got this metal plate that snaps on and it keeps the moisture out. And the little second hand is just tick-tock, tick-tock. And the minute hand moves minute by minute and the hour hand moves with it. And everything working together makes for time. It's in sequence with the sun, the universe, everything in this little watch. Well, it would be one thing to stumble across a rock. But to stumble across a watch with all that intricate design, something made the watch. I know it sounds silly and absurd to you and me as we think about it, but just note what we're railing against here is the modern day idea of evolution and Darwinism that says, no, there's no maker. That watch, the intricate design of the universe, of the human body, of the human eye, of the tongue, of language, of an ant, is all by accident and all by chance. They see, we see design, and they say, no, something just occurred over time, and enough time came together, and chance created it. And they call us silly? That takes a lot more faith to believe than to look out at the design and say there's a designer. Look at Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore, was that a design? Well, you see a mountain, you might say, well, that's been there forever. Mount Rushmore had a designer, right? Those things didn't just come into existence. The Hoover Dam. You might come across a stream one day and see some beavers that built a natural dam. Or maybe a lightning struck a log and it goes across a river and it dams up the river. But the Hoover Dam. See a picture of the Hoover Dam. Who did that? What did that? Can we say that just evolved? Design. You're in the you're in a car. You lift up that hood of the car. Car works together. Something. It's ridiculous to even suggest that car could come there by accident. How much more ridiculous that the entire universe could get here by accident? Paintings. There's a painter. There must be a painter. That painting did not just get there. And enough time, if left, if we just swirled the wind around in here and we put some paint here on this table and we circulated some really high-powered fans in this room for a while and we left for 100 years and came back on our crutches, would we see it painted like the Sistine Chapel? Could we see a single stick figure? Doubtful. Maybe a stick figure. Maybe something resembling a circle with a stick somewhere around it. And the greater and more intricate the design, then the greater the designer. Again, if we were to use the Sistine Chapel of Michelangelo and what he created versus your child's finger painting in kindergarten, the great designer, Michelangelo, would be much better than your four-year-old finger painting child, right? The greater the design, the greater the designer. Snowflakes or quartz crystals have simple patterns repeated over and over, but these all have natural causes, beautiful as they are. How about a sentence, however, etched in a stone? If you come across the side of a mountain and there's a sentence on it, Lance was here, something simple like that, versus a quartz crystal or a snowflake. Well, that's natural. And we know that every snowflake is different. I don't know how somebody knows that. I guess they've looked at all of them and put them all together. But what would you say? Would you say that Lance was here? Does that require some intelligence? Well, having that, forget. Stop it. Forget that it would be me. If you found a rock in a stream, that's natural. You're going through the stream, you're looking at rocks, so that's a smooth one. I can skip that across the water. There's an arrowhead. What does that imply? A maker. Intelligence. When we look at the teleological argument, or the design, the argument for God from the design, we look at what's called the anthropic principle. It comes from the Greek word anthropos, man. The man principle denotes the fine-tuned nature of the earth for life as we know it, for not only man, but animals and plant life, amoebas and what have you. The anthropic principle. We know of no other planet, no other solar system that allows for life. Why this one? Number one, the oxygen level. On Earth, oxygen comprises 21% of the atmosphere. If oxygen were 25%, four more points higher, fires would erupt spontaneously. And if it were 15%, human beings would suffocate. 21%. That's finely tuned for human beings to live here. The atmospheric transparency, number two on the anthropic principle. If the atmosphere were less transparent, not enough solar radiation could reach the Earth's surface. If it were more transparent, we would be bombarded with far too much solar radiation. The atmosphere composition of precise levels of nitrogen, oxygen, carbon dioxide, and ozone are in themselves anthropic constants. Everything out there, to go out and take a breath, you and I take for granted, God has fine-tuned. Well, we're not even going to assume God. Something, a designer, has fine-tuned it to where we can, where the sun doesn't kill us, the oxygen doesn't burn us up. Number three, the moon-earth gravitational interaction. If the interaction were greater than it currently is with the moon and earth, then the tidal effects on the oceans and the atmosphere and the rotational period would be too severe. If it were less, orbital changes would cause climactic instabilities. In either event, life on Earth would be possible. The moon-earth gravitational interaction. If there were any more or any less, life would not be possible. If the CO2 level and the carbon dioxide level, the fourth point, if it were higher than it is now, we'd all burn up. If the level were lower than it is now, plants would not be able to maintain efficient photosynthesis, which is the process, as you know, of converting carbon dioxide into organic compounds, especially sugars, using the energy from the sunlight. If it were higher or lower, we'd burn up. Now, when you start putting just one of these, if you put one of these things, that's interesting. You start putting a combination of all of them that must be together. Now you're looking at a watch. What happens if my watch loses a spring? Doesn't work. Even with everything else that's in there, right? What if my truck loses a fan belt? Just a $10 fan belt. It's not going anywhere. And if it does, it's going to burn up, right? Everything hinges upon one another. So if just one of these things is amazing, we might say, wow, that's amazing. But all of them working together? I'll show you the odds in a minute. Gravity. If the gravitational force were altered, this is amazing, by 0.001% to 36 zeros, that's 36 zeros and then one, then our sun would not exist if the gravitational force were altered by that small percentage. Our sun would not exist, and therefore neither would we, says Jeffrey Zwierink, research physicist at UCLA in 2003. Couple more anthropic principles. If the centrifugal force of planetary movements did not precisely balance the gravitational forces, nothing could be held around the sun. If the universe had expanded at a rate 1 millionth more slowly than it did, expansion would have stopped and the universe would have collapsed on itself before any stars had formed. If it had expanded faster, then no galaxies would have formed. Just perfect rate. If Jupiter were not in its current orbit, the Earth would be bombarded with space material. Think about that. If Jupiter weren't in its current orbit, our planet would be receiving all these meteors, and we'd all die. It's as if Jupiter was put there to suck in all of the, by its own gravity, all the meteors that might strike our planet. Jupiter's gravitational field acts as a cosmic vacuum cleaner, as it were, attracting asteroids and comets that might otherwise strike Earth. And then the tilt of the Earth. The 23-degree tilt of the Earth is just right. If altered slightly, surface temperatures would be too extreme on Earth. If the thickness of the Earth's crust were greater, the crust, what's what you dig in your shovel, with your shovel, then too much oxygen would be transferred to the crust to support life if it were thicker. If it were thinner, volcanic and tectonic activity would make life impossible. You think God tweaked the Earth when He created it? When He said it's good, I think when He said it's good, He had done all this tweaking. I think when in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then it says He was hovering over the waters of the earth, I think He had this great big mass of creation that He's about to put together. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. Tohu v'bohu in Hebrew. I love that little phrase. I just had to say that. So it's without form and it's void, and I think God begins His fine-tuning right there. As He's putting together day one, day two, 24-hour days, and tweaking it, you know, kind of like fine-tuning. I don't know how many of you remember, probably none of you 18-year-olds, ever remember playing with rabbit ears, trying to bring in the, standing on one foot, little foil over here. You know, isn't that funny that, I think, David, do you remember any of that? Have you ever done that in your life? You've messed with antennas before? Okay, all right. I think I'm 42 years old, and I'm the last generation of the last, at the end of your generation, those of you older than me, of those who ever knew what a black and white TV was, those who ever knew life without a cell phone or a microwave oven, because they were brand new when I'm a kid, and anyone born after me would have never known life without those. I was right at the end of that. Now today, you're talking about antennas or the old movies where they had the dial phones. I remember the first movie Daniel saw with that. He said, "What is that? What are you talking about? It's a phone. What is he doing?" Or movies today where somebody they're always looking for a phone. If you watch a movie 10, 15 years ago, you know, I got to get to a phone, or they're in a phone booth. Kids are going, "What's that?" That's so foreign to them. At any rate, that's neither here nor there. If the rotation of the Earth took longer than 24 hours, temperature differences would be too great between night and day. If the rotation period were shorter, atmospheric wind velocities would be too great. And if there were more seismic activity, much more life would be lost. Of course, more earthquakes. If it was less, nutrients in the ocean floors and the river runoff would not be cycled back to the continents through tectonic uplift, which means that even earthquakes are designed by God to sustain life, though they may kill them along the way. How about that? The churning up of these sediments under the ocean floor is all part of the plan. Seems. So what does all this mean? Astrophysicist, whom I'm not a big fan of, I'm not a big fan of Hugh Ross and his science, but I like calculations that are mathematical and I'm using him. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross calculated the probability that these and other constants, 122 anthropic constants in all, would exist today for any planet in the universe by chance. He's going to try to figure out what are the odds that all of these anthropic constants exist by chance. Assuming there are 10 to the 22 planets, that's a 1 with 22 zeros behind it, right? assuming there are that many planets in the universe, then if all of these constants were to come together for them like they came for on Earth, then the chances would be 10 to the 138th power. That's 10 with 138 zeros behind it. There are only 10 to the 70th atoms in the entire universe. That's amazing. Thus, there is no chance that any planet in the universe would have the life-supporting conditions Earth has unless there is an intelligent designer behind it. Now take that, write that on a paper, young people. When you're talking about your belief in God and why you believe in God, yes, you have faith. Yes, God gave you your faith. Is it founded on fact? Write down these statistics when your professor tells you to defend the faith. He cannot, or she cannot, have an argument against it. They're going to have to go to the book that you found this in and say, huh, maybe these Christians aren't so crazy after all. Maybe we are. Conclusion of these anthropic principles, there is no plausible explanation for the anthropic principle other than a cosmic designer. Believing without observation is exactly what atheists accuse Christians of doing, don't they? You guys believe that stuff because your preacher told you to believe it, or you grew up in a Christian home and mom and dad told you to believe it. Really, we're observing this. We're using scientific observations. That's what science is. Observing things, writing down findings. That's what science is. They accuse us, and yet they're the ones with more faith than us. Ironically, it's the atheists who are pushing a religion of blind faith. Christians have good reasons based on observation, i.e. the anthropic principle, for believing what they believe. Atheists don't. They just assume a universe that has been here forever and there is no God. That's all they can do. And they'll base their science upon that assumption. Five reasons to believe in intelligent design. This comes from chapter 5 in Geisler's book. Number one, life does not consist merely of chemicals. If that were the case, mixing the chemicals of life in a test tube would produce life. Life also includes specified complexity, which comes only from an intelligent mind. Therefore, materialism, which is the belief that the only thing that is really real is that which is material, it's false. Now, if you and I are made up of chemicals, you've been told this. These are some of the lies that are told today, especially when people are distributing psychotropic drugs, is that you have these chemical imbalances in your mind, and you need a chemical that goes in that connects the chemicals that are not connecting. Hogwash. There's not a shred of proof, not a shred of evidence in any medical journal you'll ever put your hands on that says there are chemical imbalances in your brain. Your brain is not a mass of chemicals that gets out of whack. Lies, nothing but garbage. Your mind, however, is a depraved and sinful part, central part of your body. Is it not? All that is evil comes from your mind, which is why we need Christ. Am I right? Okay, that might be true, but I still need a pill. No, you don't. If it were a chemical makeup, we could take a test tube, shake it up, out comes a human. But that's not what human beings are. We're not chemical makeups. Number two, there are no known natural laws that create specified complexity, which is information, obviously. Only intelligence has been observed creating specified complexity. This is why Darwinists can't explain the origin of the first life. The idea of survival assumes order and fitness. If you're a believer in survival of the fittest, and I am, only the fittest do survive. That's been proven. But in Darwinism, you've got to come up with, where did that first life come from? Where did the order come from? The first life that everything is based upon, where everything has to come from that. There is no shred of evidence. There's nothing that the Darwinists can go back to. They just go back to something in time that says, I have faith, this is the case. Our DNA, one strand of DNA, which is signified by A, C, G, and T, is specified complexity. It contains a specific message. I'm not a geneticist. You know that. I've read enough articles and seen enough 2020 reports on some of these DNA findings. I know that every one of us has a unique DNA strand that makes us who we are, makes us what we look like, what our hair color will be, all that good stuff. And in one little strand of DNA is all this information. And when you can put it all together, look at all the different ways that we look. We all look different. And then just in this small room, what about all over the world? Where does that come from? Where did that information come from? That's really what we're going back to, this design, the DNA or the DNA strand. Who made that? What made that? A lot of information in that. And there are no known natural laws that create such specified complexity. It always takes intelligence. Number three, the simplest life consists of specified complexity equivalent to 1,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. The simplest life form. A cell, a human cell. Simplest life form equivalent to 1,000. That's another thing our kids don't know today. What's an Encyclopedia Britannica? Right? How many of your parents, you grew up and you had either World Book Encyclopedia or Encyclopedia Britannica on your bookshelf? How many times do you think those volumes ever made it off the shelf and onto a research paper? I mean, they look good on mom and dad's shelf, but kids today don't know what that is, but they know what Wikipedia is. The origin of life can only be surmised through forensics, which is basic evidence that we see. You know what forensics is? It's things you can touch, these materials that you can feel that show if you're looking for a crime, they lead back to the perpetrator. Forensics, the origin of life can only be surmised through these. Thus, it should be pieced together from the evidence, not from some theory that says these simplest life forms came by evolution. Well, again, the simplest life forms have got a lot of information in them. Who or what made that? Number four, science is a search for causes that is built on philosophy. There are only two types of causes, intelligent causes and natural causes. Darwinists philosophically rule out intelligent causes. So when they look at those 1,000 encyclopedias, despite observing and recognizing their obvious design, they assert that their cause must be natural. Every time. That's why your children have more than a fighting chance against these fools that will try to teach them in the universities that there is no God and that they ought not believe what they learned in Sunday school. Is that they are looking past all that information and saying, no, that came here naturally. Can't explain how, but it came here naturally. How much more simple would it be to say, maybe there's a designer? Why would people reject such an idea? Because if he's real, they're going to have to submit to him. If there's a God, we're going to have to submit to him. And we don't want to do that. We want to live like we want to live, do we not? There's an account in Geiser's book. He talks about Julian Huxley, author of Brave New World, ardent atheist, hardcore atheist. He was on the Merv Griffin show years ago, and Merv Griffin's another thing kids don't know who Merv Griffin was. At any rate, Merv Griffin show and the Mike Douglas show and all that predated Oprah Winfrey. At any rate, they asked Merv Griffin asked him about his college days and his how he evolved and became an atheist. He didn't use a shred of science. He used sex as his reason. The reason he is an atheist and the reason he and his friends were atheists is because it gave them the freedom to act out their sexual pleasures any way they wanted. You see, if you get rid of God, you can do anything you want. It's a big burden to believe in God. He's watching. And if he's watching, I can't do the things I want to do. Therefore, let's just get rid of him. In our minds, we can just get rid of him and we'll exchange the truth for God, of God, for a lie, as Romans 1 says. And people do, and they always have. And fifthly, spontaneous generation of life, which Darwinism requires to get the theory started, has never been observed. Thus, they believe it on faith and mask it as science. So should time be given more time so that chance can put it all together? Chance is their God. They speak of science and chance as if they're personified. More time actually brings more disorder. And if you leave your house, you clean your house up, wax your tables, pledge your wooden tables, and you leave for a couple of weeks or a year, and you come back and you say, oh goodness, I cleaned that table. Now there's dust in there. If you go away for 5 more years, do you think it'll come back cleaner? If you dropped a deck of cards from the top of this ceiling to this floor, would they be in disarray when they got to the floor? They would be. If you went 30,000 feet in the air and you dropped them, would they be more ordered or less ordered? Wait a minute, I'm confused. We gave them more time to fall and be ordered. More time just creates more disarray. But if you're an evolutionist, you just add more millions and billions of years, hoping beyond hope that there's a chance in those millions and billions of years that all of this happens. And if it did, folks, this is the absurdity of Darwinism. If it did, if there's some miraculous way, they've got to, first of all, they've got to believe in miracles, that, because that would be miraculous that all this would come together. Secondly, there would be no hope for any of us. There would be no reason for any of us to do anything, quote unquote, right. What's right? We're random chance beings that exist for no purpose, no reason, and the only way we can have life is by killing the person or thing that threatens us, survival of the fittest. There will be no moral laws. There'll be nothing to, and we'll look at this next week in the moral law argument, nothing. No purpose, no nothing. And there are many atheists today that say, the only hope I have is nothing. When I die, I'll rot in the ground. I'm perfectly fine with that. Well, why do they do anything with any purpose in life? What compels these people to do anything that is moral, that is good, that is nice, and tell others to do the same thing? There is no purpose in it. I don't know how anybody who believes in such a thing can even live with themselves, can get up, can sleep, can call anything wrong. You know, again, these are the kinds of people that if they don't believe in moral laws, they're going to say, you know, it's no big deal. The woman got raped. But if it happens to his wife, now it's all of a sudden wrong. Or his daughter. Incidentally, the second law of thermodynamics proves that more time only brings more chaos. It is a law. And you can't argue with laws. More time does not make it better. And yet they keep adding to it. Michael Behe, in his book Darwin's Black Box, said the probability of getting one protein molecule, which has about 100 amino acids, he tells me, by chance would be the same as a blindfolded man finding one marked grain of sand in the Sahara Desert three times in a row. Look at that again. The probability of getting one protein molecule with 100 amino acids in it, by chance, finding three grains of sand three times in a row in the Sahara Desert. Yet one protein molecule in itself doesn't make life. To get life, you would need about 200 of those protein molecules together. Now, do those odds by 200, the grains of sand in the Sahara Desert. Chance isn't a cause. It's only a word used to mask ignorance. When people start talking about chance, they're just telling you, hey, I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. I'm just throwing the word chance in there to make it look like I know what I'm talking about. Science is actually a slave to philosophy. It can't prove mathematics and logic. You cannot prove any of mathematics. You can't prove 2 plus 2 equals 4 by science. You can't prove it by logic. Science cannot prove a metaphysical truth, anything that is done that is otherworldly, something miraculous, something that's inexplicable. Science can't prove that, which in this case would be the beginning of life in Darwinistic thought. Can't prove ethics. You can't prove ethics from science. Ethics is what right and wrong is. I think Christian ethics is a bad word to say, Christian ethics. Christian ethics are just what you do right. We would call it obedience, Christian obedience. But even if you take it outside the Bible, can you prove it by science? Can you prove scientifically that it's wrong to hurt another human being? Can you prove by science that it's wrong to kill another person, to lie? Scientifically, no. Science can't prove aesthetics, which is beauty. Science can't prove science itself. So if we're going to set it up as the cure-all and the proof for all things, then we have to be able to test science by science. That can't be done. Science can't be done without philosophy. You have to have a philosophy to do science. My philosophy might be that I believe there's a God, and because I believe there's a God, I believe God created all things. Or your philosophy might be, I do not believe there is a God, therefore my science is going to say that all things come about by chance. Philosophy dictates one science. One philosophy dictates one science. Science says nothing. Scientists do. So when you're asking a scientist what a scientist finds in his science or her science, you have to ask him first, what is your philosophy? What is your worldview? Do you believe in a God or not? That's why I told you last week, when I took the philosophy class I took at Sam Houston State, it was, I need to know what your worldview is. Do you believe in God or not? Because I'm not listening to your garbage, your foolish garbage about there being no God and you're going to try to explain the universe. I don't have time for that. I needed to know right up front. Let's just get to the bottom line. What do you believe? And you know what? I would say that when people come to church here. We'll put it on a more churchy level. And that is, you know, I've had people, one person asked me one time, how many homeschool people do you have at your church? I wrote back and said, who cares? Are you really more concerned about how many homeschoolers are here rather than not we preach the Bible? Oh, yeah, the Bible, yeah, that's right. Y'all preach the Bible? Okay, but how many homeschools do you have in church? Or somebody would say, do you sing hymns or praise songs? What does it matter? ask me, do we believe in the Lord Jesus Christ? Do we preach His Word? That's the question you ask. Had one lady, I loved her question. She's asked the best question of anyone who's called. And she said, I just need to know one thing. Do you love or hate John MacArthur? I said, you know what? That's getting right to the root of it here. Because John MacArthur is a known Bible teacher, verse by verse, who takes a very strong stand on doctrine. I said, great question. Lots of people say they're Christians. Lots of people say they believe in the Bible. I said, well, love John MacArthur. He's a mentor to me. I love him. Great, I'll be there, she said. Great question. Basic foundation. What is your worldview? Is there a God? Do you believe in the Bible? All right. Does your church have homeschoolers? Well, we fit in. That's where the question enters in. Scientifically speaking, is there a God? Okay. Do you believe in a God? Yes. All right. Well, now we know that you believe in miracles. Do you believe the Bible is His Word? Yes, I do. Now we're moving into more specifics. Got to know the questions to ask. Notice that atheists steal from the Bible. They steal from our worldview. Our own Christian worldview on personhood is this. And there's a great little story in the book on it. I hope you come across it. It's on page 130. And I've just summarized it on the slide here. But the atheist, here's the atheist worldview on personhood. It's also the Christian worldview. That a person has intellect and conceptual thought. Okay? That's a person who thinks and can make decisions. Freedom to choose and a free will. All humans have that. We choose red over black, or we choose steak over chicken. We make free will choices all the time. This is a person. A person has ethical responsibility, standards, moral accountability, obligations to keep, inalienable rights of personhood. Disagreeing only proves that this is correct. You know, I've listed it as the Christian worldview on personhood. You know, it's also the atheistic view on personhood. Atheists believe that we have these rights. Where did they get that? I know where I got it. I know that God created me in His image, number one. I know that God gave me this free will to choose. Lance, you're going to do right, you're going to do wrong. Now, I know some of you are going, huh? I thought you were Calvinist. I am. But even Calvinists know people have a free will to choose, and we do it all the time. I can't say we don't. We're not robots. When it comes to salvation, however, no one can choose Christ. God makes that choice for us. But we do make choices. That we have ethical responsibilities. God has told us, obey me. Notice me. Look out at my creation. Moral accountability. Inalienable rights of personhood. I know where I believe these things from the Bible. Where do atheists get that? Where do they get these thoughts when they don't believe anything comes from any order except through evolution? The primordial soup to a tree, to a dinosaur, to a man. Where'd they come up with that? And if they disagree, if an atheist will disagree with our view on personhood, then they only prove that we're correct. Because they exercise the decision to say we're wrong. They make a moral decision to say that we're wrong in their free will. Everything here. They're borrowing, one might say stealing, from our worldview. We know why we believe it. They don't. These, along with reason, logic, and design, and truth, only exist if God exists. Chapter 6, from the goo to you, via the zoo, Ron Carlson says, in grammar school, they taught me that a frog turning into a prince was a fairy tale. In the university, they taught me that a frog turning into a prince was a fact. Makes sense, doesn't it? From the movie Contact, we looked at this a couple weeks ago, starring Jodie Foster, Carl Sagan was convinced in the movie, and the movie is based upon a novel he wrote, was convinced that a simple string of prime numbers coming from outer space proves the existence of an intelligent being, sending a code that they're receiving on their big satellites. Yet the equivalent of 1,000 encyclopedias in the first one-celled life does not prove intelligence. Do you see how absurd these people are? They write books and they have doctor in front of their name and alphabet soup behind it, and they're telling us that there is no way there's an intelligent cause to this universe, but if we got a simple string of prime numbers from outer space, that would prove intelligence? It's just so laughable. They taught, they teach. He's dead now, but they're still out there. Some of you will go into the universities and be taught by these fools. The information content of the human brain, if written out in English, would fill some 20 million volumes as many as in the world's largest libraries. How did that get there? By chance? Did aliens put it there? Did crystals create it? I've quoted him so many times, you know who I'm talking about. Richard Dawkins, the foremost atheist on the planet today, Oxford University professor, is out there telling everybody God probably doesn't exist. He does use probably, and he tells people, how did we get here? Probably because aliens seeded our planet for life. And if they didn't, his plan B is that crystals created it all. Crystals created it all. I guess if a crystal did it, you don't have to submit to any crystal. You'll read about evolution. If you don't already, if you haven't already, you'll hear about it. You'll read books about it. In the Christian circles, we look at the difference between what Darwinists call evolution and what is natural evolution. What is evolution? And we split it up between macroevolution and microevolution. Macro meaning evolution on a huge wide scale. A tree becoming a man. A dog becoming a cat. Whereas microevolution, we see within microevolution these small changes that occur within a kind. That clearly happens. Scientifically, that's been proven. But that's not what evolution is teaching you. Darwinists are teaching you that this chair was one time had the materials of a dinosaur or what have you. And they evolved into something else. We're all the same. I remember watching Cosmos on, Channel 8, PBS, Carl Sagan. And he's sitting there introducing the show for the night. And he's hugging a tree. Literally. You know, we make fun. They're tree huggers. He's hugging it. He's patting it. He's patting the tree. And he looks at the tree. He says, me and this tree, we're brothers. Now, I wasn't even very educated at the time. And I remember thinking, Mom, is he out of his mind? What are you watching, young man? Turn that off. Never been told by Mom to turn off something on PBS until that day. Natural selection, however, is a misnomer. For if the process of evolution is, by definition, without intelligence, then there's no selection going on. Who or what is doing the selecting if there is no intelligence? Survival of the fittest, however, is true. But all that survive remain as they inherently are. Bacteria evolve stronger against antibiotics. You've been told that by your doctor. But they remain bacteria. Dogs and cats evolve into different species of dogs and cats. There are no dats and there are no cogs, however. Microevolution concerns changes within a species. Macro concerns changes into another one altogether, and yet it's never been observed. And the only way for it to be called science is if it has been observed. Now, to be fair, I did not observe, no one has ever observed, the creation of the universe. We were not there. Adam was created on the sixth day after it was already done. Even he had to take it on faith. And that's what it is. It's faith. We take what we believe on faith. They'll tell you, the Darwinists will tell you, it's all scientific fact. And yet they have never, ever observed macroevolution. Never observed changes within a species or changes within a species. They've never seen anything change into another form. Never. Well, why not natural selection? First of all, there are genetic limits built into a species. Thus, all things remain as they are. That's why a cat cannot become a dat, a half dog, half cat. It's impossible. Genetically speaking, there are genetic limits. You cannot put together. Have you ever seen a picture of a liger? I have too. A lion and a tiger. They're both cats. Have you ever seen a picture of a bear and a tiger? A biger? It's impossible. There are genetic limits within each one of those. One's a bear, one's a cat. There are genetic limits. That's why not. It's natural selection. Number two, there are cyclical changes. Changes do not produce new life forms. They simply shift back and forth within a limited range. For example, Darwin's finches that he looked at in the Galapagos Islands had varying beak sizes, which correlated with the weather. But all the finches remained finches. Their beak sizes moved and changed and evolved, but a finch remained a finch. He looked at that and said, there must be this macroevolution of everything evolving into something different. Maybe I'm looking at a finch that will one day be a man. And it was his own belief that after that there would be fossil evidence that found and discovered his theory and made it true. Still hadn't been. Still nothing found. There is what's called irreducible complexity, which really comes down to my watch or a car. Everything in the car, underneath the hood of the car, everything in my watch, it all has to work together. Better yet, just take a mouse trap. How many of you buy one of those old piece of plywood mouse traps? It's got, what, 4 or 5 pieces? Hold this. It's got a spring. You pull the latch back and you put that thing. Without one piece, it doesn't work, does it? Everything has to work together. So if one thing is missing and this mouse trap is trying to evolve, it's not going to be a mouse trap. It'll never be a mouse trap until it all of a sudden appears as a mouse trap. Irreducible complexity is composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. In other words, all the parts of each machine must be completely formed in the right places, in the right sizes, in operating order, at the same time for the machine to function as a car engine or a watch. Intermediates are non-functional. So if intermediate, let's assume that a mouse trap is moving out of the water. It was one time a jellyfish. And the jellyfish is now trying to evolve into a mouse trap. And along the way, thank you, Amy. Along the way, it has no defense mechanism because a jellyfish is in the water. He's protected from anything in the water. I guess he could be eaten, but he has some defense mechanism. He's lost his jellyfish tentacles, which send out poison because it's becoming a mousetrap. Is it surviving because it's the fittest in its intermediate state? It's going to get eaten. It's going to be gone. It's not fit. It's a silly example. We could use jellyfish to fish. We could use what they call today, what Oprah Winfrey believes. She even had it on one of her ridiculous shows was on the Discovery Channel last year. What was it called? Life? What do you call Life? Something like that. At any rate, she was talking about how dinosaurs became birds. Scales became feathers. Well, feathers are irreducibly complex. There is no transitional form. It's absolutely impossible for a scale to become a feather or vice versa. But if a dinosaur is trying to become a bird and shed his scales for feathers, in between, not only are his scales to feathers irreducibly complex, in between, he's now dog meat. He is no longer surviving. He can't fly. He can't bite. He's lost his teeth because those birds don't have Tyrannosaurus Rex teeth or any other defense mechanism. They wouldn't exist. Is it a theory? A theory, folks, at the end of the day, you make a theory from a hypothesis and it comes from scientific observation. Why it's called the theory of evolution, I have no idea, other than that the atheists have pushed it through as a theory. It's never been observed. Nothing about it is true. It's not a theory. It's an idea. And it's a bad idea. The non-viability of transitional forms, which is where I was going. Transitional forms could not survive. How could a creature survive that no longer has scales but does not quite have feathers? Feathers are irreducibly complex. Darwinists have no viable mechanism for getting from reptiles to birds. And even if a viable mechanism were discovered, the transitional forms would be eaten and not survive because they would not be fit. Molecular isolation. Darwinists think the DNA similarity between apes and humans, which is between 85 and 95% similar, implies some ancestral relationship. And if it was even closer, let's say the ape is 87% like our DNA, which is like 90%. Let's say we're that close. Does that mean that we came from such? The book gives all kinds of close genetic relationships. We're actually quite close to a pole, a metal pole, our DNA, or something like that. That might be pushing that, but maybe we have a common genetic code because a common creator designed us to live in the same biosphere. Possibly. Maybe every living creature were distinct biochemically, then the food we all share would not exist because we all eat the same things. Maybe that's why we're the same. I think those are far greater possibilities than what's offered by the Darwinists. Let's take a look again at protein before we close. Protein is composed of long chains of chemical units called amino acids. These are the building blocks of life, quote unquote. Most proteins have in their structure more than 100 of these amino acids. A protein, and within their structure, 100 amino acids, which must be in a very specific order. It is the DNA that contains the instructions for ordering the amino acids in the proteins. Notice what I put there. It is the DNA that contains the instructions for ordering these proteins, or these amino acids in the proteins. And the order is critical because any variation usually renders the protein dysfunctional. If all species share a common ancestor, we would expect to find protein sequences that are transitional from, say, fish to amphibian or from reptile to mammal. Instead, we find that the basic types are molecularly isolated from one another, which seems to preclude any type of ancestral relationship. There is no relationship. It's not there. It's not there in some scientific, from scientific proof. I love that. I love knowing that what I call my faith, that what I would die for, that what I spend my life preaching about is true, scientifically speaking. God gave it to us that way. At a molecular level, there is no trace of the evolutionary transition from fishes to amphibians or from reptiles to mammals. Impossible. Can't be seen. So amphibians, always traditionally considered intermediate between fish and the other terrestrial vertebrates, are in molecular terms as far from fish as any group of reptiles are from mammals. And what about the fossil record? Stephen Jay Gould, now deceased, staunch atheist, staunch anti-creator, hated Henry Morris and all of his scientists, said the history of most fossil species is inconsistent with gradualism. Stasis number one, the way they stay at one form. He says most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. This is an atheist saying this, that most fossils do not exhibit any change. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as they do when they disappear. Really, what he's going at is what atheists would love to see is that if a man started off as an ape over here 100,000 years ago and now walks upright like I do, that somewhere along the way, in those hundreds of thousands of years, there would be a fossil of some guy hunched over like this. How many of you have seen that diagram of an ape, some guy hunched over and it comes up? You know it's all false. All the evolutionists that have put it together have had to admit all of it's false. Have you ever heard of the hoaxes out there like Nebraska Man, Peking Man, Piltdown Man? All of them were hoaxes. They were atheists finding bones and creating an entire exhibit in a museum around a guy pulling his wife by the hair, bent over like this, and saying, this is the transitional form, and they knew it was false all along. And when it all came out, they had to admit it. Stephen Jay Gould is saying, yeah, it's true. There are no fossil evidence. There are no intermediate forms. All the fossils are like they are. We find them a million years old in their dating method, and yet that fish still exists today in the same form. Sudden appearance, he says, in any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. Don't you love using the atheist words against them?